With the docket, the next case that I have is Franklin Myers. Now, once again, I'll ask counsel in case any of you all were not here earlier, please be sure you sign in before you leave. So that's Mr. Hansen and Mr. Stout. And Mr. Hansen, sir, would you like to reserve some time for the
5 minutes, please.
5 minutes, sir.
Good morning. I'm Peter Hansen, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Franklin Myers. This case presents an opportunity to clarify several important questions with respect to both the procedure when we have a situation in which a trial court amends a sentencing order, as well as an opportunity to clarify the distinction between the competency to stand trial and the competency to knowingly and intelligently enter into a plea bargain on one's case. Because this court instructed the parties to file supplemental briefs with respect to the interplay between finality and appellate rights and other post order of rights, I'll begin with that topic. Both the Commonwealth and the defense in this particular case agree that Virginia Code Section 8.01.428 gives a trial court the power to make corrections to its final orders when there has been a clerical mistake.
And I don't think there's no dispute here that there was, in fact, a clerical mistake. Your client pled guilty to what I'll call Charge 56, because that's the...
Yes.
He was found guilty of 56, he was sentenced on 56, and the total number of years imposed by both the November order and the subsequent January order are exactly the same. The only thing that was amiss was something that actually did happen. Sentencing on 56 was omitted from the order.
That is correct. I have no reason to believe that the error with respect to the November 29th, 2015 sentencing order was anything other than an oversight.
The corrected order was truly non-protonic. It was going back. It was putting in place what actually happened live in court.
I believe that to be the case. And so we have the question, when a court avails itself of its power to correct clerical mistakes and then issues another order, what is that subsequent order for the purpose of any further proceedings with respect to that case? And I think in looking at that question, we have to look at another very well established, I would say, black letter rule, which is that circuit courts in the Commonwealth of Virginia speak only through their written orders. And I think if we want to, as we should, respect that rule of law, then logically the corrected order, at least as to the matter which it corrects, becomes itself a final order for purposes of reconsideration and appeal.
But that would allow a circuit court to have unlimited jurisdiction forever. It would never be finality.
Well, I think there would be, in the vast run of cases, there'll be finality because the circuit court doesn't make an error. The times when a circuit court makes an error, as in this case by forgetting a charge, or is certainly rare. So I think the question is appropriately framed between what is the jurisdiction of the court when it makes that kind of an error. Do we want to allow the court the ability to go and fix the mistake and then allow parties to go forward with whatever rights they may have under due process?
The logic of non-proton is that you're not doing anything when you enter the new order. It's all fiction or not, dated back to the actual event. And therefore, it adds no new jurisdictional factor. We've confronted this issue at least once in what I would call Woody 2, the remand of Woody versus the Commonwealth, albeit in an unpublished order. We made very clear in that, albeit in an unpublished opinion, that it does not extend the 21 days.
Ordinarily, that'll be the case. But as I argued in my reply brief, when we're talking about a sentence, a term of years, that just creates a threshold of due process that can't be ignored. If we looked at it from the other point of view, if, let us say, for example, that it was of no effect, and let us say further that the defendant, in this case, Mr. Minor, wanted to appeal just that one charge, there's no way for him to do it. He would have to notice up his own error and then appeal that. And respectfully, I think that most defense lawyers are going to be very reluctant, absent a very clear enunciation from this court that they must.
Well, they're
not going to do it.
If you're correct in answering that this second order is a new order, in effect, that can be appealed, from which an appeal can be taken, then you've got the problem that your notice of appeal refers only to the original sentencing order and not to the new sentencing order. So you've never noted an appeal from the new sentencing order.
That's true. That's true, Judge Petty. And that reality occurred to me during the process of studying for today's proceeding. I think the way that the law deals with that is through the requirements that this court imposes on how appellants have to frame their appeal. When the appellant petitions, the appellant has to set forth the grounds for appeal. And those requirements to provide the Commonwealth with notice and opportunity of what the gravamen of the appellant's complaint is run throughout the appeal process. That's why we have that. And in this case, that's in fact what happened. The first final, what I call the first final order, was entered by the court on November 29th, 2015. Approximately 20 days later, the Office of the Public Defender filed a notice of appeal to the case generally.
It was entered November 23rd.
November 23rd, so that would, yeah. 29th
was the motion to reconsider.
20, I'm sorry, Your Honor. But it was within 30 days. And then on January 6th, the corrected order was entered. And I would agree, if the requirement that's going to be announced is that the appeal in all respects has to correspond with the case number, then the proper procedure would have been to re-note a new notice of appeal within the required time frame following January 6th, and that wasn't done. But because notice and opportunity are provided to the Commonwealth via other procedural mechanisms of this court, I don't think that necessarily the rules need to be interpreted in that manner.
I want to leave you a little time for your merits argument, but I have one additional, the other procedural question you raised, and I just want to make sure that I'm counting correctly. The assuming away the 21-day clock, assuming that the court had jurisdiction over the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. By my reading of the record, the order denying that motion was entered on January 26th of 2016. 60 days from January 26th would be March 26th, which was a Saturday, which means that for all county purposes, we roll over to March 28th, so 62 days after, if the January 26th order is the final order, Any transcripts would be due by March 28th. The transcript on the motion to withdraw a guilty plea, where evidence was offered in support of the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, and that's what the trial court was ruling on, the transcripts were not filed in the circuit court until March 31st. So, regardless of how we resolve the 21-day issue, the transcript's not timely under whichever order we use, the transcript's not timely. Am I incorrect about that?
No. Judge Russell, you are correct on that. When I noticed that the transcript had not been filed when I was appointed to take the case, I verified that it wasn't in fact filed and then consulted the rules. It appeared to me that one of two rules controlled. Under it was 5A:8 subdivision A. I either would come to your court and ask permission to file out of time, or if I deemed it to be an omission in the record, it appeared to me that I had the option to go to the trial court, which is in fact the option that I availed myself of doing. Objected to the record on the basis that it did not appear to me to be complete. And the trial judge granted the relief that the trial judge granted. I would have to concede, Judge Russell, that if that decision was incorrect, if I should have gone under subdivision A, it's not timely, in which case we get to the question whether this court can still consider it. Because it was briefed by both the Commonwealth and the Public Defender's Office at the time, and the decision was rendered by a written order, I think the court does have adequate information to make a decision. It's not a case that would be similar to a question regarding voir dire or an evidentiary objection that is not otherwise memorialized in the course of the proceedings. This issue was memorialized.
Mr. Hanson, you're into your rebuttal, sir. Rebecca, can you hear from you if you'd like to save your time and come back? That's an option as well.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, may I please the court, Craig Taylor on behalf of the Commonwealth. Ordinarily, 21 days after November 23rd, the trial court would lose jurisdiction to do anything with respect to this. However, there is a code section 801.428, which has an exception, which allows the court sua sponte to correct any clerical errors, which is what the court did on January 6th by adding that which had been left out of the initial order. It didn't change anything. As the court noted, the total time imposed and suspended remained the same. It was just that one charge that had been left off the order. That mere act of correcting clerical error does not extend the 21-day rule, does not start the clock running again. So for purposes of any other action, the court was without jurisdiction to do anything. As a result, it was without jurisdiction to hear, in the first instance, the motion to withdraw a guilty plea, which the statute requires to be filed within 21 days of the final order. That did not occur. Also, the transcripts were also untimely, and I believe in my brief I used the wrong starting date, but I think as the court's noted, the math is still such that we're beyond 60 days after the final order for that.
What about that recent, and I can't recall the name right now, the recent Supreme Court, Virginia Supreme Court ruling that allows a trial court to correct the record by filing transcripts that weren't filed.
I believe that would be Ballew versus Commonwealth.
Exactly.
We're arguing that, so I'm familiar.
Yeah, we have that issue floating around a little bit right now. But on its face, doesn't that case allow transcripts to be filed late in the situation?
Well, in that case, what had happened was by the time the record had gotten to the Court of Appeals, there was a realization that something was missing, and that the attorney at that point went to the circuit court, sought leave to be able to amend the record, which the court ultimately said was fine. Here, I'm not sure it's the exact same scenario. I think here, and again under Rule 5A8, their opportunity was to come to this court, which is where the petition and the record had been sent to, saying, found out there's a record that hasn't been filed, and ask for additional time. Had that been done, there would have been an opportunity. It would have been timely filed given the extra 30 days this court could have granted.
The Supreme Court said that until the petition for appeal was filed, it's the responsibility of the trial court to correct the record.
And to the extent I agree that was the holding of the court, and to the extent the court finds it controlling persuasive, that's law, and to the extent that follows, then the transcript would be properly filed to that extent. However, again, I would suggest that because the statute requires a motion to withdraw a guilty plea occur within 21 days of the final order, that never happened. So even though the transcripts might be timely, the whole issue itself, the court really never had jurisdiction to actually hear the motion in the first place.
Does it make any difference that this second order did not specifically refer to it as being an order not pro tonque? Does that make a new order?
I believe it's listed as a corrected order, and it does have the new amended, one of the two. It does give some notion that it's not just a sentence or order, it's either corrected or amended order. Now, I will acknowledge that the date on it is the date it was entered, which is January 6th. It does not say on it non pro tonque back to the original date. However, the only way the court would have authority to enter that order is under 801-428 to correct a clerical error. Otherwise, it couldn't do anything with that. It would just be something left forever. Which is,
but if it doesn't specifically enter the order not pro tonque and it corrects a clerical error, do we assume that the court meant it to be a new order? And it clearly has authority under the statute to enter an order, a new order, because the statute trumps the rule.
Right. But the authority of the court of the statute is only to correct the clerical mistake. There's no indication or any authority for the argument that by doing anything, it then starts a 21-day clock running again. Now, if that new error order is in error somehow, either party or again, sua sponte, they can petition saying still a clerical error and you still need to fix it. And that would be all that the court would have authority and jurisdiction over.
It seems that it's not clear cut.
And I'll acknowledge, the first time going through this, Your Honor, I noticed there was a discrepancy in the dates, that this came in much later. And there, I know there's a body of law that talks about an order's not final unless it addresses all the issues currently before it. And there may have been an argument that, well, it left one order out, didn't address everything. But that doesn't really fit, just because at trial, at the sentencing hearing, the judge pronounced sentence on every charge. So that was done. It's not that he was not sentenced on that charge, it's just that the order didn't reflect that that's what happened. So this is clearly not a new order doing something that had not happened before. It's merely an amended or corrected order correcting that which was mistaken or correctly written down in the initial order. And even if we get past the 21-day rule and all that stuff, if we actually get to the actual underlying merits here, the petitioner, the appellant in this case, had two separate hearings on competency. Both times he was found to be competent. He went through the guilty plea colloquy. He clearly responded to all the questions appropriately. The court made a finding that he was competent. There was nothing on the record to indicate he was not competent to enter the pleas or enter the guilty plea that he did. While admittedly, defense counsel said he had some reservations about his client's ability to do that, as a matter of law, that was addressed by the trial court. It was addressed by the doctor who testified at the hearing, saying he is indeed competent. There's nothing here to say that he's not competent. As such, the court did not err in refusing the motion to draw a guilty plea. Also citing, the judge found that since this did not occur until well after sentencing, and in fact, I believe one of the letters, the defendant said, the day I found out about my sentence, I told my attorney to file this, which is clearly an indication this is merely buyer's remorse, if you will, regarding the sentence he received. It's not a meaningful attack on the fact that he wasn't competent at the time. The trial court did not hear or make that finding. So if the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With respect to the underlying issue of competency, I hope that I am clear in making the argument for the appellant that the lack of competency at issue in the case of Franklin Minor is not whether he was competent to be tried. He was competent to be tried. But the testimony of Dr. Showalter, who rehabilitated him for that purpose, And the arguments of counsel in the competency hearing were very clear that he was never rehabilitated with a view toward entering into a plea bargain. And I suggest to this court that the standards between those two levels of mental cognition are in fact different. Dr. Showalter testified that in order to ascertain the defendant's competency, he made sure that he knew what the purpose of the tribunal was, that he understood who his defense counsel were and what their role would be in defending him, and as well as at least a rudimentary understanding of the gravity of the offenses that he faced.
Would an individual who is not competent to decide whether to plead guilty or not be competent to stand trial? Isn't that part of the competency to stand trial?
The way I framed it in my mind, Judge Petty, is all defendants who are competent to plea bargain or enter into a plea agreement or plead guilty are competent to stand trial. Not all those who are competent to stand trial are competent to enter into a plea bargain or enter into a guilty plea. They are different. And that was...
A plea agreement is nothing more than a decision to plead guilty.
In exchange for something, usually.
I mean, this wasn't even... Was this an offer?
It was an offer plea. Yes, it was. Yes, it was, Your Honor. But from my reading of the record, given that there was a plea agreement filed with the case, that some certain charges were dismissed by an order of nulli prosequi, I'm going to assume that there was a plea bargaining process. And throughout the proceedings, as well as in the memoranda filed by the Office of the Public Defender on the reconsideration, the concern was that this particular defendant didn't understand what was going on. If that was the case, then his plea was not knowingly entered. If it was not knowing, it was not voluntary. But as Mr. Stahl correctly says, if this is just a case of buyer's remorse, Howell controls, and there's really not much further to discuss, the defendant would have no remedy.
Thank you, sir. We will come and greet you.